and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio, your home for the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. Remember, tomorrow on the show, for those of you that listen to the podcast, you will be able to hear our season two finale, Holzer's Ghosts episode, as we talk about the last episode of season two, Blood on the Rocks, from Cohasset. It's an amazing story. I'll be on tomorrow, and I've got some behind the scenes guests that are going to be joining us as well. Shane Pittman will be a part of the program for a little bit. Cindy Kaza, Rob Toth, our director of photography, and a couple other guests we're planning on popping in. And Mr. Tim Dennis is joining me for the season finale, season two finale of the Holzer's Ghosts episode. So that takes place on tomorrow's episode. If you are so involved and you want to watch the live video, it's tonight. That's right. You can go find it tonight on our Darkness Radio YouTube channel and on our Facebook pages. So make sure you go there, click the reminders, and it'll alert you when it goes live, or go to YouTube channel. That's the best one. And you can click on that to subscribe and get reminders. And you're always alerted when a new episode is going live or drops. And even though this is season two wrap up, we will be coming back with more looks into the season one episodes we never did Holzer's Ghosts for. We've got a special Amityville edition coming up that we're putting together. I'm very excited about. And we've got some other one-off specials we'll be doing, and some other great guests that will be joining us over the next few months. So that will continue. Even though Holzer Files is done for season two, we will wrap up the last five or six episodes of season one and bring you other great content on Thursday nights and continue this journey together. Now, Tim, speaking about journeys, if you would have told me 15 years ago that our partnering on this radio show would have helped us see parts of the United States I've never been to, been around the world, spoken to tens of thousands of people, and to have met some of the people that we've met, I don't think I could have fathomed it.
Yeah.
You know, the concept of meeting all of these remarkable humans that have had experiences to share with us. And over 15 years, we've had some of the best, some of the true experiencers of just about every paranormal genre you could imagine. Joining us today in a slightly different vein, one of our all-time favorite guests. He has been with us pretty much since the start, joining us at least once or twice a year to fill us in on the supernatural, the fun, holiday creepy critters for Christmas, and more. He is back in a much more profound way today because this is a story that is near and dear to his heart. It's a brand new book that has been released. We have a link for it in today's program guide, The Call of Kilimanjaro, Finding Hope Above the Clouds. Our researcher and writer for the Ghost Adventures TV series, and has been since episode one. He has appeared on numerous documentaries about the paranormal. He's written, I think, close to 45,000 books on the supernatural, and maybe I'm overinflating that by a few thousand or tens of thousands, but you get the gist. This is our go-to guy, and he is also the host of our New England Legends, and he's back with us today. Jeff Belanger, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you, guys. So good to be with you, as always.
This was cool, you know, and you and I kind of chatted when this was leading up, when you were going to go to Kilimanjaro, and this was something that you were so eager and inspired to do, and it was fun to watch you make that journey, that kind of self-realization that this is something that you felt literally called to. I mean, this went beyond just a, oh, that'd be kind of cool, a guy adventure, to something that you really felt called to. And maybe you can talk to our listeners about this, because it's got a lot to do with spirituality,
yes,
connectedness, and what we find in ourselves and in the world when we open up.
Well, I know, Dave, you and I have talked about like synchronicities. You know, sometimes things happen and you go, God, it just doesn't seem like a coincidence, you know, and you start making one connection to another. And maybe if I start, Kilimanjaro is a place I've thought about at the very least since the 80s, right? Toto's song Africa. You know, the as sure as Kilimanjaro rises like Olympus above the Serengeti. And I was like, oh, that's a cool song. And that's Kilimanjaro. Okay. And then, you know, in college, I took two semesters of Swahili because I needed a foreign language requirement, and I failed French. I failed it.
Wait a minute. You failed French, but you did well in Swahili.
Yeah.
I didn't even know Swahili was an option in high school.
It wasn't high school, it was college. So, So in high school, I mean, in college, my last name, Belanger, which by the way is Bélanger if we're in Canada or France. And the French teacher, I think, thought, well, you must be fluent. I'm like, I've been in America so long, it's not even Bélanger anymore. Right. My great grandparents were born in America. Somewhere along the way, they started saying Belanger. And so I failed. I failed French one. I took Spanish. It was too close to French. I was confused. But a friend said, take Swahili. And I said, where do they even speak that? And she's like, in Eastern Africa, Tanzania, Kenya, Ghana, like that whole area. And the professor's amazing. And he was. It was so cool. The guy was great. And I took like four courses with this guy. Just fell in love with the languages. And as an English speaker, I found it easier than some of the other languages. So instead of like the masculine and feminine, it's just, you know, it was a little more straightforward for an English speaker. So anyway, all that stuff. And then I was a hiker after college. I like doing mountains and I've always liked being outdoors. But the real game changer for me started way back in October of 2013. And that's when my brother-in-law got a diagnosis, one that none of us wants to get, of course. He'd been having some stomach problems. He was losing a little bit of weight and went to the doctor and they ran tests and more tests. And the doctor calls him one day and says, look, whatever you're doing, just stop and come down here. And you need to come see me right now. Don't make an appointment. Don't wait till your workday to end. And he knows doctors don't do that. So he left he was a principal at a school and he left and went to the doctor. And that's when the doctor told him, you have tumors, a lot of them. They're all over. They're metastasized. It's stage four. And you have probably between 18 and 24 months to live. And all of us were just floored. He was 44 years old, right? No one saw that coming. And Chris, you know, smart guy, funny guy. I always got along with him at family events and stuff. One of those guys that sort of hides behind a wall of laughter. And I know you know the type all too well. And I always thought, like, you know, he's a good guy. And the first guy my sister dated that I didn't think was, like, you know, a jerk. And so I was like, we'll get closer later. One of these days we'll really talk more. But then suddenly you hear that news and you don't have later anymore. And the funny thing about 2 years is that it's weird, right? It's a long time and it's not at the simultaneously. It exists in equal states of being as not very long and still quite a bit of time, a long time to face down that dark tunnel of what's coming. But it does go. And he and I got a lot closer. And because of my paranormal background, because of all the haunted places and ghosts and weird subjects I've covered throughout my life and career, he calls me one day and he says, Jeff, you're into some pretty weird stuff. And I said, yeah, you don't have to tell me that, you know? And he said, I'm going through something pretty weird. And I said, yeah, you are. You know, the thing about death is that I don't think you're supposed to say goodbye, right? We're not supposed to see it coming. The natural order of things is that you don't wake up one day or you're in an accident or a heart attack and it's all over. But to see someone dying that you cared about a little before, but as you get closer, you care more and more. That was really difficult. And of course, he and my sister had at the time, 3-year-old son when he was diagnosed. And looking at that kid and going, you're not going to have a father pretty soon. And he's so young, he doesn't grasp that yet. And so trying to be there for support. And my sister was just in denial, you know, like just, okay, well, we'll fight this thing. And he did the chemo and radiation, but he was just going downhill. And then it's December of 2015 now. And, you know, I remember taking him to a football game and we got to see, you know, the Giants and the Patriots play. He was a Giants fan and I had to wheel him in a wheelchair, but we were closer. But he's in the hospital because things are now starting to get bad, as they do with cancer. And he calls me like the second day in the hospital and he said, hey, Jeff, something really strange happened, man. He said, I was in my hospital bed. And the next thing I know, I was out of my body, like 20 feet up looking down at myself. And he said, and I know that doesn't make any sense. The ceiling of the hospital room couldn't have been more than 10 feet. And I was like double whatever that was. And I said, what'd you do? And he said, I'm afraid of heights. I got scared. And then it was over. I was back in my body. And I went, oh. Now, I've sort of heard stories like this before from people who are getting near the end of their journey. And then he called me again the next day and he said, okay, it's now happening multiple times a day, except I'm not quite as scared now when it happens. And I said, can you control it? Are you doing anything? He said, no, I just sort of float around and then it's over. I don't seem to have much control over this thing. And he wasn't really telling my sister about it because, again, she doesn't want to hear this stuff. And then he's in the hospital maybe like a week or so. And that's when the doctors tell him, you know, hey, it's time to go home to hospice care. There's nothing more we can do, which is just like the worst thing, right? I mean, that's the worst thing you hear from a doctor. This is it. This is all we can do for you. And so he went home. And they rented a hospital bed for him, and he had an oxygen machine and a hospice nurse. And it was about the 15th of December. My family planned to go to Connecticut to go see him. And it's weird taking a trip like that, where you know what you're doing. You know, like this is nothing, no other way to label this thing. This is not a visit. You know. This is the real goodbye. And we talked, Dave, we talked for like 3 hours that day. And when I walked into his bedroom, the windows were open and it was a bright sunny day and his skin was golden in color. And I know it's jaundice. I know it's because his liver and his kidneys are failing and to remove the toxins from his body and that his skin is so yellow, but the way the sun was hitting him, he was just golden. And he was just enlightened and at peace. And he just talked so freely about this strange thing he's going through, you know, this thing. And we spoke for hours. My sister went grocery shopping.
Do you believe he was in a moment of acceptance or grand denial at that point?
No, acceptance, because he spent a year plus in denial. I know what that looks like. I watched it. He spent that first year after the diagnosis was just depression, horrible depression, mm-hmm. and just going downhill. And then once it became pretty obvious that there's not going to be much fight left, he started to make peace with it. And at this point around the 15th, I saw peace. I saw peace and clarity, and strange to say it, joy. That he gets to have these conversations. Every second seemed like a gift to him. And it was one of the most profound conversations of my life. And I asked him, I said, well, tell me about the out-of-body experiences. Are those still happening? And he said, yeah, like multiple times a day now. He said, but now I'm also seeing things. I said, what do you mean seeing things?
Right.
I said, yeah. He said, first I saw my cat from childhood. And he said, the funny thing is I didn't even like that cat. and then he said, but then I saw my grandma and I was close to my grandma. I said, did she say anything? Did she do anything? Like what happened? And he said, no, she was just there. And I said, what do you think all of this means? And he said, I feel like there's something inside this broken machine that's getting ready to get out and stay out. And pretty soon it's just going to stay out. And, he wanted me to tell my sister and tell others. And so I have. And he passed away a week later. And my 5-year-old nephew was left without a dad and my sister without a husband. And that was really, really hard on all of us. Just this like thing, like, oh my, he was 46 when he died. And stuff like that forces you to reassess everything. You know, you realize how short life is and that you've got to just take opportunities when they come up. So back to Kilimanjaro, it was about 8 months after his death. And I was at a paranormal event where we were, you know them all too well. We were taking a group ghost hunting. We're having pizza dinner. We were going to raise money to preserve the place. And this friend of mine from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society says, Jeff, we have a new fundraiser coming up. And I said, oh, Amy, I'm so busy. You know, like I got so much going on, but, you know, I'll help if I can. And she's like, we're going to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. And time stopped, Dave. It was just right out of a movie. I was walking in the door carrying some garbage to throw away. And I just stopped mid stride and I just went, Kilimanjaro. She's like, she didn't know I took Swahili in college. She didn't know about the right. Toto song Africa as a kid. She didn't know I've hiked mountains in college and after college and that place has been on my bucket list. And I don't think she knew that I just lost my brother-in-law to cancer months earlier. And I was like, go cross this big item off my bucket list. Do it to raise money for cancer research at a time when I'm about the same age my brother-in-law was when he was diagnosed. And I was like, Amy, I'm in. I mean, how many times in life, Dave, does the universe put something on a golden platter, you know, and put it right in front of you and say, here you go. You just have to nod.
Right. Probably more times than I want to admit when I forgot to nod. But right. No, I get your point, right? That alignment and things coming together to have this kind of, you know, synchronicity almost seems like a too generic a word in a moment like this, doesn't it? Like it doesn't even encompass the true emotion of what that's like.
Yeah, it was big. And I just, I mean, and by the way, you know, it's going to take 2 weeks. It was going to cost a lot of money. You know, I'd have to fundraise, I'd have to train, I'd have to do all these things. And, to be ready to go the following March. And that was, 7 months away, 8 months away. I just committed to it. And this is the part you remember. I told everybody I'm doing this, Dave, I'm climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. I told everyone in part because I didn't want to come back and tell you I failed or that I didn't do it. I figured that the more people I have to answer to on this thing, the better. And that will help motivate me. And I think it did. It did for sure.
Right. That accountability and putting out what your intentions are and why they're important. It helps to remind you so we don't get complacent and well, maybe I can do this another way. I'll honor him by, you know, rooting for the Patriots again this year. Right. Something
right.
That doesn't mean as much, but you held the accountability, and that's pretty remarkable. I remember I could hear it in your voice. You and I talk a lot and we're usually goofy and poking fun and making stupid comments, but there was a different level to the commitment that I heard in your voice at that time, and dealing with your grief and loss and finding a way to honor not just your brother-in-law, but your own life in a way to get more out of it, to milk the experiences that many of us will overlook or think we can get to another day.
Yeah, I was due for an adventure for sure. And, you know, I hate to use the term midlife because I can only hope I'm in my midlife, right? I can only hope that I don't get that diagnosis a year from now and realize this isn't the mid at all. This is near the end. We don't know. We don't know how much time we're given. And so in that moment, it was just this big decision. And it felt important. It felt huge. And then I started fundraising too. And I know you gave money. Like so many of my friends and people I hardly knew gave so generously. And I started raising money. And I didn't realize how much that would motivate me. The more people who donated, I was like, oh, I can't tell Dave you donated to this cause for me. And I didn't make it, right? Like,
right.
To have that many people like do it just because you asked. It was over 300 donors, which was incredible to me. No matter what they gave, I was so deeply touched. Some people gave $5. Some people gave hundreds. And like everyone, I was just like, oh, I'm amazed by it. And it was so motivating to be like, this many people believe in me, believe in what I'm doing, are doing this just because I asked. And I know cancer's, you know, kicked you square in the, you know, in the gut multiple times. And I know, I mean, who at our age hasn't lost someone to cancer, right? I don't know if I've ever met such a person. That's the reality. When you get to a certain age, you know someone, you've lost someone to cancer, someone close.
Right.
Yeah. So this journey became a physical one, but I had no idea just how deeply and profoundly spiritual it would become. I mean, I you know, you have a sense. I'm going to Africa. I'm going to, you know, the highest mountain. It's 19,341 feet tall, right? It's the tallest freestanding mountain in Africa, and it's one of the seven summits. Like, this is people die up there, you know, and a lot of people fail to get to the top. And I just became so singularly focused on this thing for, you know, 7-8 months. And that's what you remember those conversations we had where I was just right. like, Dave, I got to do this thing. Yeah, it was a big moment for sure.
How, you know, for listeners, Jeff, that are in that position of wanting to be and do more than they've allowed them to in the past, but they run into those walls that we put before us, right? The obviously one of your tips is make it public. Another, yeah. make the commitment, right? And find ways to make it follow through. But for people that are kind of looking to have this type of experience, what do you really think is a good first step for them to start in doing this?
Well, what I love about mountains in general, and I've done mountains around New England that are, you know, obviously nowhere near as high or as big or whatever, but you have to realize a mountain, it can be very intimidating. And what I love about the mountain as a metaphor is that there's mountains that end up in our way through no fault of our own. You lose a job, you need to get healthy, you need to get over a breakup, you whatever. Like, those are mountains that we have to climb and we have no choice. But then there's the ones that we do put in our own way. And those can be the most satisfying, especially if you commit to them. Climbing a mountain it's kind of impossible. They're huge. They're too big. But you can take one step and then you can take another step. And if you break down this seemingly huge task to just one little step at a time, it's not so intimidating. And so my first step was like, how do I train? How do I, you know, what do I need to do? What foods do I need to eat? What gear do I need to get? And the more I prepared, the more I felt like, okay, I'm ready to tackle this thing. I'm not throwing myself into something. I'm going into it knowingly and prepared, and I'm reading up on what I need to do and what it's going to be like. And I trained hard for this thing, and boy, what a fitness goal, you know, like, I would do my workouts and I'd go to the bar with friends and I'm like, oh, do I really need that giant cheeseburger? Is that going to help?
Right.
You know, and you go, and sometimes you're like, yeah, I do need it. This one's for my soul, not my stomach. But I ate better. I was exercising better. Everything was just so focused. And then, you know, finally, and I felt so guilty too, by the way. Like, this trip was costing like $5,000. And I don't have that to throw around. That's a lot of money for me. And I know in the grand scheme of things, for a life-changing event, $5,000, I mean, shoot, people go on cruises and spend more than that, you know?
Did you feel at all in this commitment as you got closer to that day to head there? I mean, it's one thing in theory, right? Yeah. It's another to be on the plane heading there. Another thing to be on the ground looking up. Did you feel your brother-in-law with you at any of these points?
I would, and we will get to that. Okay. I thought about him a lot. I thought about him through training. You know, just like, oh my God, you know, like my life could be over soon. That could be me. I mean, there, but for the grace of God, go I, you know, I mean, that you can't help it. And so, by the time it was time to go, and I'm feeling guilty about missing work for 2 weeks, missing my family, taking this money, we could take a family vacation with that money, but I'm using it just for me. And it feels so selfish. But then, you know, I got on the plane and I'm excited too. There's this thing, and it was 4 years ago right now. I was in Africa, right? And just as I start to get over there, and when we land in Tanzania, I've never seen poverty like that. This is really a whole other world. We're in the city of Moshi, which is just outside of the mountain, and it's where we're going to stay for a couple of days before we actually begin the trek. And walking around, like, their middle class would be our, like, abject poverty. You know, tin shacks with no windows could be considered middle class in some parts of Moshi. And just the extreme poverty. And I never felt like a rich white guy in my life until then, until walking around and realizing, like, wow, I mean, I've got like a few hundred bucks in my pocket, and that's all some of these folks make in a year.
Can I address one thing?
Yeah.
You made an interesting comment to me there about feeling selfish.
Yeah.
Like, this was something you were doing, and this is money that could be spent on the family or could be allocated elsewhere. But in a sense, in doing something like this, and this is when you have to start to reexamine, and it's not making an excuse, but you reexamine, there are choices I make that could be on the outside considered selfish. But on the other side, I show my kids, look, this is what you can do when you set your mind to it. This is achieving a goal that's greater than the sum of the parts. You're doing something. You are putting the effort into it. You're enjoying the fruits of that labor and being able to see these things and then come back with something that you can share and educate or enlighten the children or your wife or your family about. So there is kind of that importance of being true to yourself and being true to understanding in order to help others. Sometimes it looks like we're being selfish. Sometimes it may even to ourselves, but we have to realize the bigger scope of it is there's more to this. And I bet that your daughter, knowing how intelligent and sweet she is, got that aspect more than, boy, I didn't get to go to Disneyland because of dad this year. She got that concept.
Yeah,
and that's important. And I don't want you to belittle that as part of your journey either, brother.
No. And I appreciate that. And as the days would go by when I'm on the mountain, I would find myself sort of transforming in my thinking. And that was, it's funny, when the book came out, one of my publisher put, like, I went to Africa to find clarity. Like, that's in the jacket copy or something like that, right? And I did a email interview with a website, and they said, oh, you went there to find clarity. And I was just like, let me just say right here, the publisher wrote that. I don't think you go anywhere to find clarity. Like, if that's not your, like, clarity is something you trip over when you're looking for something else, right? You're just like, whoa, what was that? Oh, clarity. I had no idea that was down there, right? So I had no grand design. I'm just a guy, right? I'm just like a guy that wanted to do this thing. And by the way, so people understand too, Kilimanjaro is not a technical climb. So it's not like you're hanging from ropes and hammering spikes into rocks and stuff like that. There's a path you could take that you could just walk yourself up to the top. It's going to take 6 days, by the way, to get to the top, 2 days to get back down, 42 miles of hiking in total, like that. You got to walk all of it. There's no cars or anything. And that's daunting. And so once we got onto the mountain, I was about 50 yards up the trail when I realized we had begun. And I remember back home, I'm like, I'm going to take a picture of that first step. I'm going to maybe video it. Like, this is the first step on the mountain. And I forgot. Dave, I forgot. I was so scattered. My brain is in every little place, right? Thinking about, oh, what about my emails? There's no Wi-Fi up here. There's no cell signals, nothing. And I'm like, what about my family? Okay. Did I lock the car before I left? All these things. And I'm already on the way. And then I was thinking, like, well, where was the first step anyway? Was it really 50 yards ago? Or was it this morning in Moshi when I stepped out onto the roof of our hotel and I saw, Kilimanjaro and all its glory way out on the horizon? Or was it a few days ago when I got on the plane in Boston? Or was it when I left my house? Or was it like, and you realize every story, none of them start at the beginning. None of them, right? You just jump in somewhere. And so this is where I jump in. And the first step is I couldn't even define it anymore. I mean, I know waypoints along the way. Chris's death, a huge one, and taking Swahili, that's a point in the road, and running into Amy from the Leukemia Lymphoma Society, yeah, that was a point. But then we're on our way. We're just on this journey. And so it's almost like, when you come out of a movie theater on a matinee day and it's really bright out and
right.
It's blinding, right? You're just like, I can't see a thing. Like, all of Africa, the whole rainforest of Kilimanjaro sort of feels like that right now. It's just so blinding that it's out of focus. And it would just take this idea of walking. And pole pole, the guides say over and over in Swahili, it means slow, 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 pole pole. And we're walking at a pace, like if I was in front of you at the mall walking this slow, like you'd just push me out of the way. You'd throw me over the railing. It's just so slow. And yet, you know, we're at 8,000 feet in elevation, and you and I have been higher. Remember, we were in Cripple Creek, Colorado. That was like that was 9,000 feet. And so at 9,000 feet, if you're standing still, right, you don't really notice it too much, right? But walk up a flight of stairs.
Or smoke medical marijuana, and boy, do you notice it.
No idea what you're talking about. I have some idea what you're talking about. Or just remember, like, I think we were at some bar down in the middle of Cripple Creek, and I'm like, I'm going to run back to the hotel. And I and you guys drove, because it was just like 2-3 blocks. It was nothing. And I got up there and I was like, I'm going to pass out. it's really different. And so we're only at like 8,000 feet and going so slow. And later on, you'd come to appreciate that slow pace, because once you get to 10,000 and 11,000 and 12,000, boy, Cripple Creek sounds like a picnic compared. So we know. And the Stanley Hotel, and that's at 7,000 or 7,500 feet above sea level in Colorado. So we've been in places that are higher up than you're used to. And then and we're just like, every step pretty soon is going to be higher than I've ever gone. So this whole thing's sort of coming into focus now. And then one of our guides says, look over there. And, you know, you look up in the trees and there's monkeys up there. And you're like, oh, my God. I mean, I've seen monkeys in zoos and stuff, but like, this is their turf. I'm on their land now. And there's these monkeys. I'm like, if they want to jump on my face and tear it off, there's nothing stopping them from doing that.
Mr. Glass half empty.
Right? I'm like, holy cow. If they just said like, hey guys, attack. Like, we're goners, you know? But you know, they don't seem too interested in us. They're up there in the tree and we're just walking along and making our way to the first camp. And so,
let's do this. Day. Let's take a quick break and we'll come back and continue the journey along with our host and guide on this mission, Jeff Belanger. The book, Call of Kilimanjaro, Finding Hope Above the Clouds. We'll talk about the supernatural, the serendipity, and the rest when we return. Remember, there's a link for today's book in our program guide, so make sure you do get the book, rate, and review it. We'll be back with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the program. This is Darkness Radio. Remember that the journey of a lifetime starts with the first step that you take every day. Don't let the past determine your future. Don't let the failings that you've had determine whether you can succeed going forward. Every day begins a new journey, as we're learning with our guest, Jeff Belanger, today. His book, The Call of Kilimanjaro, Finding Hope Above the Clouds. The book is out and available. Link for it in today's program guide. Please go order that book. You're going to absolutely love it. It is an amazing journey. All right. Talk to us. You've made the first steps. The journey has begun. Base camp. Where do we go from here?
So this is just the first camp. There's going to be many, and this is the first night. And by the way, Dave, I am not a fan of camping.
You and me both, we're not avid outdoorsmen that way.
No, so this is the okay, so here's the difference. Like, I love to hike. I will, you know, I'll leave it at sunup and I'll hike all day long and you know, get back all dirty and sweaty, but then I want a shower, a hotel bar, and a big feather bed. Right? Like that's more fun to me.
and an apple teeny. Is that asking so much?
No, not at all. While I look at the monkeys out there in the Serengeti. So, we get to this first camp and there's our tent. And Brian, who's my tent mate from New England, we never met before we started training for this a few months earlier. Good guy, easygoing guy, but also like a camping pro. You know, like everything's in the neat little bags and perfectly set up and he's ready to go. And I'm looking at this little tent. And it's the tent small enough, like it's enough room for two of us, our gear. You can't stand up in it. It's just, you know, whatever, waist high. And then I have this self-inflating mattress pad that is intended to keep a 195-pound man off the dirt floor of Kilimanjaro. And I'm looking at that going, is that going to keep 195 pounds of me off the ground, like while I try to sleep? And I unroll my sleeping bag, and it's the sleeping bag's this big. It looks like a ski parka, like you in Minnesota, you know, like the big parkas, but it's a sleeping bag. It goes around your face and everything. And I'm unrolling that, and I'm literally, from outside, it must look like the tent is trying to eat me, because like I'm just falling around and flailing and knocking gear over, and you know, just I'm such a mess at this, and I'm just like, am I cut out for this? And then, you know,
and this is first camp. I like it.
This is first night on the mountain. Yep. I'm like, you know, we were in a hotel the night before, which was fine, perfectly fine hotel. It was, you know, simple but clean and nice. And now, as I lay down to get ready to sleep, because there's nothing to do, we go to bed at like 7:30, you know, at night, because we're going to start around 6 the next morning. And I lay down. And I go, huh, yeah, no, this mattress pad is not going to keep a 195-pound man off the floor of the forest. And I'm like,
and yeah, there ends Dave's first journey up Kilimanjaro. Like,
this straight up sucks. And I'm like, not comfortable at all. And I'm trying to move my body around in a way. And after a few hours of that, it starts to hurt. And you start thinking, man, I am getting so soft. Right? I'm in my 40s and look at me, like, there's no room service. There's no Starbucks. Where's my Apple Teeny? You know? And it's, you know, 8,500 feet in the altitude, and it's just a rainforest, and we're luckily it's not raining. That would just be perfect.
Right. So now the forest's not even living up to its expectations. Disappointing.
So I lay there for, you know, the next 10 hours. Mm-hmm. And then it starts to get gray outside, and I'm like, ah, oh, sun's coming up, I guess. And so, you know, I get up and I get out of the tent and I stand up and I hear it's, you know, like when you step on bubble wrap.
Yeah.
As I stand up to stretch, it sounds like that. Just pop, 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 pop. But it's inside of my body. It's making that noise. And I look around and I'm like, well, I know from history that I can do one all-nighter and still be okay. Can't do two, though. Not anymore. But I can do one. And so that day we start walking again, pole pole, and we're heading up. And as we get higher and higher, the colors start to drain from the world. Like, it's just these pale green lichen, and the trees get smaller and smaller. Because once you get to 9,000, 10,000 feet, the air is starting to get thinner. To give you an idea, if you ever fly in an aircraft, any aircraft that flies above 10,000 feet must carry supplemental oxygen. So like Cessnas and small single engine planes, they don't have to, but they're meant to stay below 10,000 feet. So once it's day two and we're now pretty much going to stay above 10,000 feet in one way, shape or form for the rest of the journey. And I realized, like, huh, if we were in an airplane, we should have oxygen. And,
That little bit of information is always helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. Am I cut out for this? Am I cut out? And at the same time, all I'm thinking about is like the goal, the goal, the goal, the goal, get to the summit, get to the summit. And we're walking along, and now there's no trees anymore. It's just underbrush that's maybe waist high or chest high, as tall as it goes. And then just, you can see hundreds of miles out into Africa. It just opens up, which is, it's beautiful. It's stunning. The view is incredible. And we're walking along, but I haven't seen the summit in 2 days because we've been in the forest. There's just no way to view it. And we're coming up the western slope of the mountain. And then the 2 days before, we're going to loop around the bottom of the summit and then make for the top from the east. So that's the path we're taking. It's called the Lamoshi route. And the reason it takes so long is it helps you acclimate. The longer you spend above 10,000 feet, your blood is, you know, getting used to it and oxygenating more and things like that. So we come around, and then finally I see the summit for the first time, and it's right there across the plains, and it looks so close, and I'm so excited. And it's like, imagine you're in a bar and your favorite all-time celebrity just walks in, and you're like, that's Mark Hamill from Star Wars. Oh my God, what's he doing here? You know, it's like, that's how I feel looking at Kilimanjaro. And now we're at Shira One Camp, which is the second camp that we're going to spend the next night. And I did some research ahead of time. So Kilimanjaro is the tallest freestanding mountain in the world, meaning it was not formed by plate tectonics like the Himalayas, which are taller, but it's a volcano. And Shira 1 camp was the first earliest part of the volcano. Kilimanjaro is actually three different volcanoes. And this was the first one that went off about a million years ago. And the other thing about Kilimanjaro is the volcano is dormant. It is not extinct. And so that crosses your mind.
Sure, yeah.
You're like, if this goes off and I can run about at this altitude, maybe 4 or 5 miles an hour, I'll outlive by 8 seconds the guy behind me. You go, yeah, if this goes off, that's checkout time. There's nothing to do except just, you know, hope. So the second night, and by the way, so Dave, it's a plateau at like 11,000 feet and it's wide open. And when the sun goes down, there is not a cloud in the sky. And I have never in my life seen a sky like that. I mean, the Milky Way is right there. There's no light pollution. There's no pollution. It's the cleanest air I've ever breathed. And I'm in space and it's absolutely breathtaking. And just as I'm gazing up, I reach into my bag and I pull out Z-Quil, the sleeping aid, and I pop one. Because I am not messing around.
Well, I got to know how to. I know when, from the pure Stanley effect, you have to be very cautious when drinking or taking medications at that elevation, because it can affect you. There's it help no sleep? Okay.
So I took the sleeping pill at like maybe 7:30 at night, 8 at night, and I was just unconscious for the next like 10, 11 hours. It was glorious, and woke up and I'm like, all right, drugs are the answer. Sorry, kids. The way you tolerate sleeping on a million-year-old volcano is drugs.
Right. It makes complete and utter sense to me.
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, pro tip. That felt great. I woke up. I'm like, oh, I needed that. I slept. I'm good. And so now as we get going, right, this whole landscape starts to turn otherworldly. But then like you see a sign of someone who died, someone struck by lightning. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. I mean, because the clouds move by you at this altitude, like they move through you, like next to you. You know, you see it coming and then it goes right by and through you and then it's gone. And you're at their level. And I was like, oh, some of them look sort of gray. I mean, if one turned electric, what would I do? I mean, I've got my poles, I've got my batteries and cameras on my backpack, and like there's plenty of metal on me. And they said, well, you just drop your pack and you dive behind a rock and you hope for the best. And I was like, okay, all right. So there's that.
Now, are you seeing, now I know the climb to Mount Everest, you will see bodies.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, some of them are markers to let you know what elevation or what point you are in your journey. When you say that you see residue from a death, I mean, are you seeing a body? Are you seeing
no.
So pieces?
Yeah, no. So it's someone left a marker, like probably about a 1 foot square stone plaque that had been professionally etched that just said, you know, in memory of the person who died right there. And it had the date and their age and everything. And it was just left with some flowers that had been, you know, dead for a long time. So someone who cared about that person came back and left a plaque where they had died. So yeah, there's no body. The bodies are taken off the mountain. When people do die there, even at the very top, there's no bodies that you're going to pass on Kilimanjaro. It's low enough that they can get them down. But that was just the first marker. There would be others where people have died, and that's sobering. You're just like, oh my gosh, like some people don't come back. And still all I can think about is the goal. And as you know, for the next few days, it's a lot of hiking. And some of the people in our group are starting to not deal with the altitude too well. One guy in our group he said, when I lay down in my tent, it spins around. Like when you have the bed spins from drinking way, way too much. He's like, it's like that. And I went, oh yeah, when I lay down, it's stationary. And so, we're at a place, called Karanga Camp, and two of the people in our group had to turn back at that point. Cause we had medical checks every day where they're checking your O2 level. They're checking, you know, your vitals. Are you eating okay? Are you going to the bathroom okay? All that stuff. And two people had to turn back. And at this point it gets real, because now the journey's really turning inward. And yet I keep thinking about the top, and we just lost two people of the 12 that were with us, 12 Americans that came to do this. And now the terrain is just Tatooine in Star Wars. That's exactly what it looked like. just barren. Nothing grows at this point, and we're heading to Barafu Base Camp, which is the last camp before we make for the summit. And that's at 15,000 feet. And at that point, when you stand perfectly still and relax, you can breathe okay. But just to walk, just walk on a flat surface 10, 15 yards feels like a sprint, and you're just trying desperately to catch your breath. And this is the last stop. We're going to be here for a few hours. We're going to eat some food at like 4, 4:30. And then we try to sleep because they're going to wake us up at 11 because we need to start for the summit at midnight. And it's only 3 miles away, but it's going to take 8 hours to get up there. And that night, I wasn't going to take a sleeping pill knowing I have to get up soon, you know, and just laying there. And I had my iPod with me, and I remember listening to Toto's Africa, you know, and hearing that song at 15,000 feet on Kilimanjaro. And I was just like, all right, man. And at this point too, like, it gets so inward. I'm no longer thinking about the email. I'm no longer thinking about my phone or my family. I know and trust those things are going to be okay and be safe. And I realize now I'm actually unplugging, and it's a byproduct. I never would have guessed. It took a few days to be up there to be like, I'm okay. I'm completely unplugged now. And I'm in a good spot. And that wide-eyed kid that used to like look at wonder at the world around him, you know, like suddenly he's still in there. And the other thing I realized, Dave, which is awesome, is that, you know, when you're at 15,000 feet, there's no bugs, there's no animals, there's nothing up there. Nothing grows, there's no water except what you bring with you. And you realize like it takes grit to survive up here. And when you get to a certain age, like when you're young and you're literally trying to scrape by and pay your rent and you know, like you know you got grit, you need it. And then you get sort of comfortable as you get older, usually, you know, and to be up there and be like, hey man, I still got the grit. It's still there. I need it, and it's there when I need it. And that was empowering to feel that.
I bet. Now so, what was it like though to see people decide to stop their part of the journey?
That's the thing. They didn't decide. The guides decided for them. They said, you are not going on. You know, your O2 levels aren't good. Your vitals aren't good. We need to bring you down off this mountain. You're going to go with these guides and they're going to take you down and we're going to get you off this mountain today. I'm not sure they would have made the decision. And that's the other thing. You're like, I don't want this taken away from me. Dave, every donor, I had it printed out. It was in my backpack with me the entire time. I would look at the list every night in my tent and just be like, look at all these people. I had photos of Chris and photos of my family. Right. And I would look at those every night. And I'm like, I want to come back and tell you this story. And so when we leave at midnight, it's as cold as I've ever been. And I'm a New England guy. I'm used to it. I've got good gear for it. But man, oh man, it is cold. And we have headlamps on to see. And it's just like tan sand around us. And you just follow the guides and you follow the footsteps in front of you. And moving ahead, what was that?
Sorry about that. I don't know. Suddenly my phone just fired off and started playing a video in the background. I apologize.
It's haunted.
I don't know if I had said something or you did and it overheard and thought I was supposed to launch something, but either that or the spirits are listening, my friend.
They are listening. So as we start for the summit, man, it's so cold. And I stepped out of line just to take a picture of our group. And I stepped back in line and I just could not catch my breath. It was like having an asthma attack as a kid. If you want to know what it feels like, you breathe through a straw, a drinking straw, and then go running, just breathing through that straw and see how far you get. It just can't get enough air in, and we're going and it's getting later and later and I'm absolutely frigid and I'm not coordinated. I feel like I'm drunk, but not the fun drunk, just like the completely like stumbling drunk. And it's about 3:30 in the morning and my brain is just empty. I'm oxygen deprived. I'm sleep deprived. I'm exhausted. We're probably at about 18,000 feet and I don't think I can go any higher. And that was such a frightening moment. How could I get this close and turn back? What do I do? And I can see our guides who have done this mountain, literally one of them did it 200 times. And he looks concerned. And I'm like, oh, it's like when your flight attendant looks concerned, you know, and you're on a plane. You know, like you're fine until the flight attendant looks scared. And then you're like, oh no.
Right. Right.
This isn't good. And he looks concerned, and we still have a long, long way to go. And I just, you know, at this point, like, you're just, I feel like there was this inner dialogue happening in my head, and I'm not privy to the conversation, but I just follow the feet in front of me. But then, like 4:30 in the morning, I turn around, and there's just a little bit of purple way, way out on the horizon. And we're way above the clouds at this point. And I just see this little purple, and I say, okay, the sun's coming. It's on its way. And then, you know, you keep going a little further, you turn around, and it's a little bit brighter, a little bit brighter. And finally, just as we're getting to the crest of the volcano, just the edge of the volcano, a place called Stella Point, I turn around, and the sun has broken up through the clouds. And I'm just, every emotion pours out of me at once. I laugh, I cry, and the Maasai people of the Serengeti have a word for the top of Kilimanjaro. It means the house of God, or where God dwells. And in that moment, I absolutely felt the presence of God, or the creator, the universe, the spirit of the mountain, whatever term you want to use. I felt it right there. And I felt judged, and I felt that I've been deemed worthy. And also in that moment, I felt Chris. I felt Chris right next to me, standing there looking at that sunrise. And I snapped a picture, and because everything was just so stunning at that point. And he was there with me, and I felt all that. And in that moment, I was like, I knew right there. There was another 500 vertical feet to go, another half a mile. It's going to take another close to an hour. But I'm like, right there, I'm like, this is done. I'm going to make it. Like, right. Absolutely. No, I'm going to make it. I'm sure of it. It's just nothing left to do but finish this. And we gather our stuff, and just, you know, you drag yourself, and you see glaciers that they say are going to be gone in the next 10 years because of, you know, climate change. And I'm seeing things that people may not see again. And you get around, and then there's the sign way in the distance, this thing, the goal. And it just gets closer and closer. And then I reach out and I touch the sign, and I am there at the summit of Kilimanjaro. And we take our pictures. I took a picture of me holding up a photo of Chris and my nephew Henry together. And I wanted to show Henry, like, hey, your uncle's strong. Look what he can do. And I'll be there for you. And I'm up there. And we only have like 10 minutes because there's no air. You can't breathe. And we got to get back down. We got to get all the way down to the Barafu camp again, and then go further down to the next camp to get off the mountain the day after that.
Wait a minute. So you spend 6 days.
Yep.
Toiling, roiling, broiling, sleep and air deprived to get to the top long enough to take a picture, turn around, and come back down.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And here's ready? I'm about to make it worse.
Okay.
So we're up there, and that's when it's the wisdom that I had heard before, but it sort of hits me. Oh my God, this spot where I'm at right now, this is halfway.
Wow.
This is the halfway point. Huh. You have to get down. This is, if you don't get down, none of this matters. And then it occurred to me even more than that. This isn't halfway down the mountain, right? This is halfway home. I have to get back home. I have to get back to Massachusetts. I have to get back to my family. And then suddenly that expense that I was feeling so guilty about, I realized, like, I have transformed over the past few days. Like, I have become a different and better person. I saw the mountain, like, you know, this is a million-year-old volcano. There's broken rocks and lava flows and, like, just pockmarks and erosion. And it's been beat to hell for literally a million years. And yet this is one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. And I'm taking pictures up close because there's this pile of broken rocks. It looks like if you took like 1,000 dinner plates and shattered them. And I take pictures because I want to show my daughter, you know, like, hey, this place is beautiful. Few would argue it's beauty. And it's beautiful because it has been battered and beaten and knocked around for a million years, and it still stands tall and proud. And that's really what beauty is. And I wouldn't know it unless I saw it that close, unless right. I saw it up, you know, up close like that. And, you know, once we come back down and it starts to hit the gravity of it, like, I need to not just get off this mountain, I need to get all the way home. And the goal, for so long, I've been such a goal-oriented person, get to the top, the goal was, it turns out, was never the summit. The goal was home. That's where every journey and every adventure begins, and it should end. Because then you come back and you have that story to share, and right. you have this transformed person to bring back. And like you said earlier, like, you know, you're worth the investment. I didn't look at it as like frivolous spending anymore. It was an investment that already paid off. And it was life-changing. And to feel that connected, you know, I was raised Catholic, and I wandered away from my faith willfully, unapologetically. I looking for ghosts and haunts brought me to a more spiritual place. But being on that mountain and going through the test that I put myself through willingly, and getting up there and seeing that sunrise, oh my God, that sunrise, it was just the most profound spiritual experience of my entire life, and I will never forget it.
So being up there, even for that brief moment, feeling the sense that your brother-in-law is with you, whether it's truly his spirit or the spirit that you carried in you of his grit and determination, was there any other supernatural element to this trip, and especially at that moment to you? Because at that moment, you're really probably closer to death than you've ever been until that moment happens in life, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was probably the most perilous adventure I've been in. Yeah, for sure. You know, it's funny. You think you're facing your own mortality, and you do that by putting yourself in peril, which seems just like not the brightest move. But at the same time, it just made a lot of sense that I get to keep forever, Dave, that I can climb Kilimanjaro no matter what challenges face me. Now, as we were making our way back down, I found like my conversations with the guides and stuff were very different than on the way up. Like, we did it. We got the pictures. We saw and did these things. And now that we've got 2 days to come down, I got to just chat more. I wasn't so like distracted with the goal. Like, well, we got it. And so the Chaga people, who live more on the Tanzania side, have a very interesting sense of spirits, ghosts, everything, right? They believe that the spirits of their ancestors are always with them. But not only that, what you do today can affect them. Now, that's different than a lot of Western thought, right? In Western thought, you're done, right? That's, you know, the book's written, you're finished, and nothing can affect you now. Now you're beyond it, you know? Over there, not so much. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Like, what we do can anger our ancestor spirits. It can please them. It can endear them. It can do all kinds of things, all the things that can happen to regular people. And so we sort of talked about some of those beliefs and so on. And it was just such a enlightening thing. And to get so close to a world and remind myself, like, hey, the first humans came from near there, you know, that walked out of Africa all those many hundreds of thousands of years ago. And to sort of get all the way back there myself just felt kind of amazing. I just felt this connectedness to not just that mountain, not just my spiritual self, but like just my fellow human beings being back at like the where it all began all those countless millennia ago.
I know there's this sense of accomplishment when you see something like this. I mean, nowhere near what happened on Kilimanjaro for you, but you and I were slated 8 years ago to go to Romania together, and we were going to do this trip. And through a strange twist of events, your daughter got very ill and you were unable to go. And literally days before the trip, I suffered a non-fatal heart attack. And, and when I was telling the doctors I need to go to Romania by the end of the week, they were like, dude, you're having a heart attack. I'm like, yeah, I get that, but 20 people paid to hang out with me in Romania. You know, can we do this another way? They accommodated me, and I went there, and walking up those 1600 steps to the top of Polonare Castle in Romania, Transylvania, Dracula's castle, it was winding, tiring, but there is this eloquence to, I shouldn't even be here.
Yeah.
And here I am. And not only am I here, but I'm sharing this moment with kind of the world, in the sense that I've made it. I'm coming back down. I will talk to people about this experience, the trials and tribulations of marching up that hill. And you're right. Sometimes we've got to look back. And although my climb was not to the summit of Kilimanjaro like you, I need to remind myself of those baby steps. And even in that accomplishment, I did something that nobody thought I could do, including myself at first. But I had to put one foot in front of the other and make that trek to do it, and not let limitations beat me, or self-limitations.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. And I remember that killed me. Like, if it was me that had MRSA pneumonia in my lungs back then, I would have gone, but it was my daughter. And that's the only thing that kept me back from going on that trip. And I remember being in her hospital room in Boston, watching what I'm pretty sure was my plane, be like looking at my watch and going, yep, that's probably the plane I would have been on the way to Romania. And it was so heartbreaking. But you realize, you know, there will be other mountains to climb. There will be other adventures to have. And that's the other thing, is that, you know, I don't want to get so singularly focused that this is it. Like, this is all I get now the rest of my life. I'm thinking of the next thing.
Right.
Right.
But even in that moment, it was synchronistic, in the sense of, what are the odds something would happen to you and your daughter to keep you from going, which in essence pushed me to keep me from collapsing into depression or overwhelmed by the sense of mortality, and pushed me to go on? Because had you been able to go, I would not have. I would have stayed.
Right.
But it's weird how those things work out. And I'm sorry, of course, at the risk of your daughter's health, but I'm glad kind of things worked the way they did. I would love to have shared that experience. And of course, we still have many years ahead of us to do that again. But it is weird when you look at those things and you realize how many wheels were in motion to make something happen. And maybe we shouldn't take these things for granted so often.
No, I completely agree with you. And the other thing too is to never lose this sense of hope that I think is so very important. When I saw that sunrise at the edge of the volcano, I took that picture. The picture came out so good. I had it made into a big print. It's hanging on my wall. I look at it like almost every single day, and I realized like that sunrise provided so much hope. I mean, it warmed the world up by like 15 degrees. Like it just, you felt warmer. You could see things. You could look around and see where you were now, and to have everything change in this very simple, mundane, boring event that's taken place every day for billions of years, right? The sun has risen, but to see it differently, that's made a big difference. So no matter how bad my days get, and I still have bad days, I'm not some enlightened anything, right? I'm just a guy like trying to work and do my thing like everybody else. But no matter how bad it gets, I'm just like, okay, the sun is going to rise again tomorrow, and I got another shot at this. You know, there's hope. There's a hope and the sunrise for tomorrow, and let's see what that brings. And that's been one of the big takeaways for me too.
Now that you've had that type of experience, how do you hold that and not become complacent to that as just another, you know, remember when we used to go to Blockbuster? Right? Do you know what I mean by that? And I'm not trying to diminish the deal, yeah. But sometimes, you know, even if, you know, I don't hold into account that same reverence I once did for what I accomplished.
Yeah. And but I think that's sort of important too, right? Like, so you honor it, but like, come on, Dave, you love Bruce Springsteen, right? Glory days.
That's right.
Right. Like,
oh yeah.
You don't want to be that guy. You know,
you, Tim and I will be sitting in a bar talking about the glory days. Trust me, it's gonna, we're already doing it. So it's just a matter of time. But let's make those glory days effing glorious so that there is so much fun to talk about.
Well, right. And let's not have it be like one or two things. Let's have it be like 30 or 40 or 50 things, right? Like, so that's the thing, right? There will be more adventures. And when I came back from Africa, I had a hangover for like, I don't know, 6 months. Like, what now? I had this huge, huge goal. I went there, we did it. Now what? Well, what do I do? You know, now what do I do with myself? And what's next? And I started writing. I wrote it all down. I wanted to remember everything. I had journals and I took 1600 photos and like, I was just putting it all down and sort of realizing like, hey, this might be a book and someone else may want to hear the story. And so that sort of got me going for a while. And now that it's out, I'm just like, okay, well, there it is. Right. Like that gets us all the way full circle. But it's been neat. You know, the feedback so far has been really positive and it's appreciated, and finding that, you know, again, like Kilimanjaro is just my mountain and it is a metaphor, but I just hope that people identify their own Kilimanjaros, whatever that may be. And that you make the decision to sort of put it in front of you and climb it, because that's so important to find your own grit as you get older and know you still got it. You still got it. We can still scrap with the best of them, you know? But you got to test yourself sometimes to remind yourself of that, because it is pretty easy to get comfortable and complacent and just sit and watch Netflix in your sweatpants and, you know, just do it all again tomorrow. So I think sometimes
Why are you looking at me so judgy-wudgy when you say
that? I don't know who needs to hear this right now, but maybe his name rhymes with Shmave Raider.
I'm sure it's not Kim Plenis.
Maybe.
Are you kidding? I come back from the dead more than Lazarus.
That's true. That is true.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, that's why Tim doesn't want to believe that the zombie apocalypse is a real thing. He's already part of it. He wants to keep us all clouded, folks. You just heard his admission. Amazing story. The book is truly beautifully written and a great homage to not just your brother-in-law, but to all people that are looking for something beyond the limitations that they may have put on themselves in the past. And I think it's going to stand a testament to not just your story, but the human story, that we are all more than the sum of our parts, and we can see and experience things and maybe be in those moments more often. Like you said, you unplugged and you realized, hey, I'm okay. I can live without bombarding myself with Facebook posts or Twitter or Instagram or whatever. And people can survive without knowing what I ate for dinner tonight on my social media post. Yeah. And it became more about being there and being in that moment.
Yeah. Just walking, living, breathing, you know, getting to the next camp. And life got so simple on that mountain. I miss it. And I do miss it. I still would not call myself a camper. I would do it if there's no other options. Like if that's the, you know, right. but at the same time, like that unplugging part, it's so important because we are humans and sometimes you need to be away from the machines to remind yourself of that.
Amen. The Call of Kilimanjaro, Finding Hope Above the Clouds. It's out and available. We have a link for it in today's program guide. Jeff, it's always a pleasure catching up with you, man. And thank you for doing what you do and making humanity accessible to many people in whatever form you choose to write. And this book is deeply powerful, not just for your story, but because the story that you share is something that is, I think, base and elemental in all of us.
Well, thank you. And it's I appreciate the opportunity to share the story because it's a dark and sad place for me, but also like this profoundly amazing and spiritual place. So it's and I feel like you can't tell one without the other. So thank you.
Have you felt your brother-in-law with you since, or do you feel that was a release for both of you?
Yeah, I think that was a big moment. In fact, he even said when he was getting close to the end, he said, I'm going to work out signs with, you know, my sister, and they had signs they had agreed to. I always thought it would be with me. I always thought he would appear to be because I don't think my sister could handle it, number one. And I'm not saying that to degrade her in any way. I just think that it would set her back. And he knows that. You know what I mean? I think like our loved ones know it would not be a helpful thing for me to show up for you.
Right.
Right. But if I showed up for Jeff and the message got to you that way. And so maybe that was it, right? Maybe that moment on the mountain. I've given my sister the book and she's not ready yet. And that's okay. She knows it's going to make her cry. She knows it's going to put her through a lot of emotions, and I accept that. And it's okay that she hasn't read it, but I did tell her you still have to buy a copy. That's just the decent thing to do. You know, a sale's a sale.
I love it. Very good. Tell her to give me a call. I'll sell her my copy for half off the cover, and I'll even autograph it.
Wow. That's a deal. I will. I'll
Jeff's sister signed Jeff's friend, Dave Schrader. I like it.
Wow. That's awesome.
Man,
you're the best.
It's great. I like to help where I can. Brother, yeah. Keep breathing, keep doing what you're doing and sharing, and we will see you this year when the world opens up and we can attend events. I think, God willing, and the Crick Don't Rise, the three of us will be reunited, you, Tim, and myself, at Phenomenology in Gettysburg. We have links for it up at darknessevents.com, a paranormal conference that's supposed to take place this June, as long as people are in order. I know we're all getting our shots to try to maintain safety. So hopefully we'll all be back to the new normal and a better normal soon.
Amen. Look, I can't wait to see you guys. We all need it. And I will call ahead to the bar and make sure that they've doubled whatever they planned on.
That's right. That's right. Tune in tonight, kids, live on both Darkness Radio's YouTube page and my social media pages. You'll be able to see tonight's season finale, Holzer Files, Holzer's Ghosts, as we examine the case Blood on the Rocks. And it is Tim Dennis will be joining me tonight, along with Rob Toth, the director of photography for the entire series of Holzer Files. Cindy and Shane will pop in. There might be some other surprise guests, so make sure you tune in. Check it out tonight. And then that episode will be made available tomorrow in podcast form for those of you that prefer to just take us along on the ride to work and on the way back. Thank you for making us a part of your lives, and strive to be better than who you are today. And remember that just because you may be 40, 50, 60, 70, that doesn't mean that a new journey doesn't begin tomorrow. So take those first steps and realize that before you know it, you're already halfway up the summit. Enjoy your lives. We'll see you again here next week, right here on Darkness Radio.